Have you ever wondered how to make sense out of your messy life or how to live in peace in the middle of a stressful world? My name is Jamie Norton, and I want to welcome you to the Making Peace and Beyond podcast. In almost 50 years as a counselor, I have seen a lot of life happen, and this podcast is going to cover all of it. So thanks for joining us while we explore life's struggles and how to live in the peace, joy, and freedom that Christ died to give us. One of the things I love about what I do with the podcast is I get to talk to people I really care about. And today, Robin, I'm so glad you're here. Robin,
thank you, Jamie.
Is one of my favorite people. He's an anomaly. He is a recovering Christian psychiatrist, which is probably maybe the only one of two or three in the world, but he is a delight, and we have been friends, and I just admire and respect his professional abilities, and also admire and respect him as a man and as someone who is willing to be who he is, and I just welcome you here. Thank you for showing up.
So honored to be with you, Jamie. I'm pleased that you asked me.
Tell people a little bit about yourself and why you do what you do.
Okay. Yeah, I never expected to be a psychiatrist. I tell you that it wasn't even on the list of possibilities when I was thinking about medical school or anything like that. Back then, if I would have had Google, I would have Googled the highest paying specialties and picked one of the top three, whichever one of those three I liked the best. You know, that was just my mindset at that time. But, God didn't let me get into medical school, you know, for a while until that mindset changed. And, a lot of brokenness, a lot of humility and change. I had a nice 7 years of recovering myself, you know, and then during that time is when he finally gave me the opportunity to go to medical school and led me into slowly but surely deciding to go into psychiatry. And it was really working with people in addiction that captured me. And, certainly because of my own experience with my own alcoholism. There was just a sense of understanding, what they were struggling with, you know, or my wife would just say, why can't they just stop? You know, that's really all I need to do is just stop, you know, or somebody who doesn't really know addiction would think that's what's needed, you know, just say no. But there's so much more. There's so much more required because it's just such a deep and desperate kind of sickness, far more than just enjoying, the high. But, working with a cocaine addict that was suicidal on one of the units during a psychiatric rotation, you know, made it clear this is what I was supposed to do. So I knew I was going to do addiction services or addiction medicine, and then following that path showed me that psychiatry is probably the best background to have. And then once I got into psychiatry, I found I really enjoyed all of psychiatry, not just the addiction, but most of my work has been, a mix of both.
Yeah, that's one of the things we have in common is our recovery. In fact, that's how we met, was in a recovery meeting. So, and it's been a long journey since then, and we worked together a lot with different clients. And it's just, it's so nice to have you there. And I think, like you, I have worked for so many years to help people to understand the complexities of addiction and growing up in addiction and being married to addiction, and just how broad addiction is. It's not just alcohol or drugs. It's so many other things. And I think it's really sad that it still carries such an aura of shame and guilt for the people who have it. I mean, one of the hardest things in recovery is to embrace the fact of your own addiction without feeling the guilt and shame about it. I mean, any more than you would cancer or diabetes or high blood pressure. I mean, whatever it is that is there, to be able to say, this is something that is so big and so physical and mental and spiritual and every other thing. I think that's the hard thing about addiction. It's everything. It's an everything disease. Mm-hmm. It affects every aspect of being a human being.
Absolutely.
And it's so complicated. And it's like the elephant. Wherever you touch it, it looks like that. The leg of the elephant's a tree, and the tail's a rope, and it's like, and the side is a wall, and so we find in the church, people tend to see it as sinful. Mm-hmm. In the mental health field, there's a tendency to see it as a symptom of something else. In the family, you're just bad. Mm-hmm. You just don't care. And so there's so many different definitions depending on what your point of view is. What I hope to do today is to really look at you have a clear way of talking about the physiology and also the rest of it. I mean, you understand the whole disease. And so I just really am looking forward to what we're going to do here.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Yeah, so, I mean, like you said, it's when we can we start to look at it as something like diabetes or hypertension? And, you know, that's why, you know, you had me do that presentation about the disease model of addiction. And that's something we did do regularly at Oakview in the intensive outpatient program is, you know, trying to help the people that are new in recovery understand that, hey, this, you got to see this for yourself as a disease. And that's so hard to do. That's so hard to come to as an individual. I think even for myself, it was easy for me to consider disease in others, you know, disease in my patients. But when it came to myself, no, it was just so steeped in regret and shame and guilt and, you know, all the hurt that I'd caused others, you know, ignoring the hurt that I'd caused to myself even. So it really took me, even as a clinician, a long time to accept it as a disease in myself. But clearly, you know, it is. You know, we see it in the genetics where it can be passed down from one generation to the next. We see it in the physiology and the changes that it causes in the brain when you look at functional MRIs of, you know, an active addict versus somebody who's, you know, had some time in recovery versus the normal brain. So clearly there's, and then the experience of, you know, tolerance, you know, is clearly a biological phenomenon where somebody needs more and more to get the same effect. And then, you know, it, you know, when we start using, it does something good for us. You know, it relieves this, you know, anxiety and tension that we've been struggling with prior to that moment. And then, wow, you know, it's like something we've never, this a relief that we've never been had access to before. You know, I can just drink this and feel good, you know, or I can just shoot this or snort this or whatever it is, you know, or gamble this and get some joy juice, you know, a little shot of dopamine. But the further we go down that path, then we get to the point where, you know, we're starting to have those physiological consequences, you know, where it was good in the beginning. And then as it progresses into an addiction, you know, we get to the point where we're sick if we don't use. And at the end, we're sick if we don't use and we're sick if we do use, you know. And,
real double bind.
Yeah. Yeah. And then hopefully that's where we, you know, hit our rock bottom and get that gift of desperation, the ability to finally come to some point of surrender and start seeking the help we need. But before that, you know, I just remember being ashamed. I just remember being ashamed of myself, hiding the addiction, you know, drinking before going to an outing, you know, drinking before even going out to say hi to my wife, you know, hiding the bottles while I'm drinking them while we're watching television, you know, going out to the garage, going down to the basement, running out to the gas station, you know, so all kinds of crazy stuff like that. And, you know, she didn't give me a reason to hide it. It was my shame and guilt. But the more I hid it, the worse it got. The more I isolated, the more alone I was, the more I wanted to drink, the more terrible I felt. And the whole thing is just this, you know, vicious cycle, this snowball that controls everything, you know. It didn't matter. It didn't matter that I was neglecting my family. It didn't matter that I, you know, was sick in the morning, couldn't go to work. You know, it didn't matter that, you know, I wasn't earning an income to support my wife and kids. I still couldn't stop. The consequences were not enough. I needed help. I needed help. I couldn't just say no.
You know, I think for me, you mentioned a couple of things. You know, I think I was probably, I've been sober almost, well, over 45 years now, which is a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's older than most of the people out there. But it's like, you know, but I remember probably 2 or 3 years into recovery, I was talking to a client because I said, you have a fatal illness. Mm-hmm. And I heard myself, because I think even into recovery, I didn't understand what I had, you know, and I thought, I have a terminal disease. Mm-hmm. I have something that's going to kill me and living inside me, mm-hmm. you know, and it was just shocking. And I remember just feeling like I can't show that right now. but having grown up in alcoholism, I remember talking about hiding. I didn't understand it then, but my parents would have company. Both of them ultimately died of their alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And so being among, and they were successful people, and their friends were successful people. So it wasn't the common idea of what an alcoholic is, because you know, we were people who had stuff, you know, but I remember they would have friends in, and they would have mixed drinks. And two things about that. One, my father would go to the kitchen to mix some drinks for the company, and he would be taking shots. He called it sink drinking. Mm-hmm. He would take a shot while he was in the kitchen, then mix a drink to come back and drink in public. You know, and that went on. Well, a lot of his friends went with him, you know, so it was not uncommon for the men to go back there and some of the women. You know, it was, mm-hmm. But as a child, I was fascinated because the people I grew up with were very stiff and properly social. But I noticed that when they took that stuff, they loosened up and mm-hmm. they started laughing and having fun, it looked like. And so I was curious. And we had a beach house, and they would give us little shot glasses full of beer. Mm-hmm. I mean, little orange juice glasses full of beer, really. And about half of us didn't like theirs, but I liked mine. And mm-hmm. so I would get them to get theirs and then give it to me. And so, and then they would take the mixed drinks back to the kitchen. They would be diluted because the ice had melted. And I would drink what was left in the glasses. Mm-hmm. And I remember one time there were cigarette butts in the glasses or something. So I poured some out of the bottle, and it about choked me to death because I was so young. I had to reach up to the counter. I don't know, but it was always a fascinating thing to me. And I remember just starting to drink as a teenager, thinking, this gives me safety from the chaos at home. This mm-hmm. gives me, I can be less shy. I can be more cute, you know, and you don't realize that you're just drunk. Mm-hmm. You're not cute. You know, drugs are drunk. But we have this euphoric recall mm-hmm. thing that says it was really great, and we romanticize it. And as a culture, we romanticize it. So we're swimming as a culture in so many things. And just to really say, wait a minute, this is not fun. Mm. You know, when you and you don't know whether you have a problem or not, because what I was doing was normal. I knew I was crazy. I knew I was bad. I knew I did stupid stuff when I was drinking. But I didn't get it that I was an alcoholic, because what, you know, when your normal is abnormal and you make normal adjustment to abnormalcy, guess what? You become abnormal. And so that's what was happening to me. And it took a God intervention to really help me to, because I was working in mental health. I was married to a psychiatrist who was also an alcoholic and drug addict. And we were living on the campus of a psychiatric hospital in the early 70s and making marijuana brownies for staff picnics. I mean, it was nuts. I mean, you had to shake your keys to show you weren't a patient. I mean, it was so bad. And God just intervened, and I went to the first program on alcoholic family systems therapy in 1978. So, and it changed everything because finally I knew what was wrong. And I jumped on it, started beating the system up with, this is important, you need to listen, you know. But anyway, it's been a long journey.
Mm. Yeah, the denial is so incredibly thick, and like you said, it's so ubiquitous, so available, so accepted, so glamorized, you know. You know, if I watch a football game alone, right, how many beer commercials and food gluttony commercials
absolutely.
Am I going to be tempted by?
You know, talk a little bit more about how the brain adapts to, I had a funny story the other day that just sort of reminded me of what you talk about in terms of dopamine squirts. I love the dopamine squirt phrase, mm-hmm. you know, but I had a TikTok that was getting ready to get to be a million, and I got it that it was probably going to go there. And so I got compulsively and increasingly attached to checking it. And there'd be several thousand. And I'd be getting this little dopamine squirt. And it got more and more frequent, you know. And finally, it hit a million. And it was like this moment. And then it was total off the cliff. I mean, I was just gone. And because in TikTok, when you get to a million, it's 1.0. So you don't get any other dopamine squirt until you get to 100,000. And so I went into this kind of withdrawal. I was disappointed that it had hit there because I was having so much fun checking it. You know, but the anticipation phase is something you talk about a lot.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, the first time we hit anything, you know, it's the best time, right? It's fresh, it's new, or naive to that substance, and so it gives us such a dramatic effect. And you know, the whole reward system is a beautiful system, and when it functions normally, it reinforces healthy living, healthy relationships, working hard and getting acknowledged for it, or working hard and getting whatever rewards come from that, or taking care of our children, receiving their love, or the love of our spouse. Those all give us, dopamine surges, to tell us how important those experiences are. It's not just dopamine, but that's the one we know the most about when it comes to the reward system in the brain. And, those things, those beautiful moments are burned into our memories. And, I remember the first time I held my first child.
You still tear up when you remember that. I'm so glad.
Because it's there. The beauty of that experience, is so powerful. That it's such a huge spike of wonderful biological markers that it burns into the amygdala as in hippocampus as something incredibly important. But then when I do an addictive experience, it artificially spikes that system without really giving me a reward. It short circuits the system. It bypasses the system. It gives me the signal of something rewarding without me doing something rewarding. And the problem is the signal is so much stronger, so much more intense than a normal rewarding experience. So it's like, wow, this is good stuff, And one of the things as an addict, I'm addicted to feeling better.
More now.
Yeah. Whether I'm feeling terrible, or I'm feeling great, I want to feel better. A little alcohol would make this even better,
My biggest danger point is at high moments, not at low moments.
Yes. Now that's what I'm finding. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because in the low moments, now that I've, in recovery, I know to, hold on tighter, because I need more program. I need more support. But yeah, when things are going good, it's easy for me to, stop going to meetings, stop making those phone calls, stop doing my prayer time, my readings, and, all those things that keep me spiritually protected start to go by the wayside. And, then I'm at the edge of the cliff and I'm wondering how I got there. But, so those rewarding, those artificial rewards spike the system so much more. And so, they really burn into the amygdala and hippocampus as, ooh, that was good. And then we do it again, but we don't get as much, of a spike. And then we do it again and we don't get as much of a spike, but each time we're going, it takes us up, but what goes up must come down, and the pop up is a little less high and the down and the drop down is a little more deep. And as we keep going, we go from normal baseline becomes abnormally low. And if I wasn't comfortable at this normal baseline, how comfortable am I going to be when it's down in the pits? I'm going to be so much more drawn to something to help me feel good. And then before you know it, we're at that point where we're using, people will tell me, I had to use heroin. I had to snort heroin just to be able to get out of bed and get to work, just to be able to function. They're not even trying to get high anymore. They're just trying to be able to function, just to get by for the day. And we tell ourselves, tomorrow, I gotta, I got to survive today. You know, tomorrow I'll quit. And then that's the biggest lie I ever told myself. And it's so easy because, you know, tomorrow, you know, tomorrow's tomorrow.
One of the classic books in the early recovery was called I'll Quit Tomorrow. It's by a guy named Vern Johnson. He ran the Johnson Institute, which is where I went. And and just the whole, I mean, that is for all of us. I mean, it's what we do about death. I'll die tomorrow, but I'm not going to die today. You know, I mean, it's like we always think we have more time. You know, we can do it at another day. Yeah. And one day never gets here because whenever you wake up, it's today.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really, but it is. I mean, there is this idea that people have that, and I wanted to just, you know, do a moment there, is that people who are alcohol and drug addicted don't work. And we're using in order to work. You know, that's the, and so at least for the majority of the disease, for a lot of people, you're looking good. I mean, you're using it to look normal. And when I was in North Carolina, I worked with all the impaired programs, the impaired physicians, impaired nurses, impaired airline pilots, impaired pharmacists, impaired attorneys, you know. And what you find is that addiction is an equal opportunity employer. You know, it doesn't care what you do. It has no consideration at all of what you do. It strikes where it strikes. And and some of the things, I got to the point where I was almost afraid to walk out the door because you got it that you can be in an operating room and half the staff may be on something. You can be in an airplane and the pilot's still getting sober. You know, you can do a lot. I mean, it's not something that's hidden on the street corner.
Absolutely. I'd say that most of the people that I've treated that struggle with opioids, initially the opioids helped them so much. They felt like, you know, superheroes. They could clean their house in a day. They had all kinds of extra energy to work extra hours at work. You know, but that was short-lived, and then they needed more and more and more, and then it got too expensive. Then they had to use it in different ways to get the same high. Then they have to, instead of swallowing it, now they're chewing it, and then after chewing it, then they're snorting it, and then after that, they're going to start to use it IV, and then things really spiral terribly, terribly out of control.
I think one of the ways that somebody who maybe doesn't have an addiction can understand addiction a little more is if you've just had surgery and there's a shot of morphine beside your bed, but you're not supposed to have it. You know, how much are you going to hurt before you go there? And so part of staying away from it is learning to work a program of recovery. And you mentioned what you have to do, and I know what I have to do in terms of keeping myself at that level of okayness, you know, because recovery is wonderful. I mean, I'm, when I first came into recovery, I would hear people say, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, and I'm sorry, are you crazy? How can you be grateful? How can you be grateful for that? You know, there's no way that you could, and now I think I am, because I think I could have, having been a child of an alcoholic, there was a lot of me that was not okay, that was stuffed down. And I think I could have circled that black hole inside myself for a long time had I not had something that brought me to my knees.
Yes.
Something that made me surrender.
Yes.
And found, number one, you know, Christ. I mean, I had grown up in the church and had decided that God either didn't love me or was impotent or didn't exist, and so, you know, went on my own way, thought I had failed Christ, thought I had flunked Jesus, you know, I mean, it was, but forced to come back in a humble way and know him in a different way, you know, forced to join a community of people that were vulnerable and able to talk about what their life was like, you know, been able to really find that peace I had always wanted and the wholeness I had always wanted, and really see how God used all of that, as he does in all of us, to my aunt used to say, God must have a big job for you because he sure is giving you a rough training program. and I look at how God has used everything that ever happened to me to help others, you know, to reach others who are still hurting. You know, and you know, the 12 steps of recovery program are incredibly powerful. Yes. As long as God, as Jesus is the God of your third step. The one thing that is necessary is to have an outside source of forgiveness. So the mm-hmm. God, you know, if Christ has to be the God that you turn yourself over to, mm-hmm. you know, because otherwise you're stuck just being honest in the rooms of mm-hmm. recovery, but you're not able. I told somebody one time, does your God keep you downstairs? My God lets me walk around upstairs, you know, because I don't have to walk in guilt and shame because I do have a Savior.
Mm-hmm.
And I, to me, that's just such a great thing. So I'm glad to be a recovering addict.
Mm. You know? Absolutely. Because you're right. I wouldn't have got here without it.
Mm-mm.
There's no way. I wouldn't have been awakened to the character defects that I struggled with. They would have stayed there and been reinforced until I had that gift of desperation that alcohol brought me to.
Mm. Yep. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. But going back to your question about what it does to the brain, you know, so when let's say opioids, for example, let's say I start out using a pain medication, and it's hitting those receptors and muting them, so I don't feel the pain. Well, the body's going to respond to that. The body's going to adapt to that, and you know, it wants those pain receptors to be functional and ready and sensitive to tissue damage. So if I'm muting that system with opioids, then the body's going to increase those receptors. So it builds more. It puts more receptors in place. So now I need more of the same opiate to fill those additional receptors, you know, so I need a higher dose to get the same benefit. And then eventually, you know, the more and more that occurs, the further and further I'm going to go into, you know, potential addiction. And then if I get on that path, and then we realize, oh no, you know, we've gone too far. Now we need to get rid of this opiate. You know, you've become addicted to this. We take the opiates away. Those receptors, you know, those extra receptors have been added and added and added with each dose increase. More receptors have been created by the body to overcome that suppression of the system. And now I'm just a raw nerve. I'm so much more sensitive to pain than I ever was because of that process of building tolerance to the opioids. So in the beginning, I come in terribly overwhelmed and sensitive and hurting, and I'm going to need all kinds of support to go through, you know, initial detox, but also, you know, just after detox, however short that is, right? It's shorter and shorter now. But, you know, let's say I get to that first week of detox, I'm not out of the woods. Those receptors haven't changed at all. So it's going to take several months, probably a good 18 months of post-acute withdrawal syndrome and all the support that I'm going to need to fight through that in order to, you know, get to a place where I can feel a little bit better than I was when I came in. We don't even think that it gets all the way back to normal. You know, it depends on how much we've been using, how heavily and how long we've been using all determine, you know, the prognosis of that full recovery or not. But in the end, we're probably never going to get back to fully normal. We're probably going to stay a little bit hypersensitive. So that support we need is, you know, the support that I've been able to find is, you know, things like IOP, things like rehab, but then continuing that with, you know, having a 12-step home group, having regular meetings, making phone calls to other people in recovery, reading about addiction, in the books of recovery that are available, but prayer and meditation, all those things helped retrain my brain to give me something to live life on life's terms. I've taken away my best coping mechanism. So now what? You know, how do I live life? You know, I halted my emotional and spiritual development at whatever age I started using that alcohol as my coping skill. When that became my coping skill at 14 years old, my emotional development halted, didn't go any further. So when I got sober, I was a man with a 14-year-old mentality when it came to emotional tolerance and emotional wellness. And, you know, that doesn't work well when you're in your 40s and you've got a wife and two kids and two more coming. So, it took a whole lot of parenting Parenting for Mothers in Recovery, parenting from you as my therapist, to bring that child, that 14-year-old alcoholic child, up to a place where he could start to be a father again.
You know? It's I think another really common misconception is just stop using and then everything will be normal.
Oh, no.
And you know, another friend of mine said one time, Al Mooney, who was also an addiction medicine mm-hmm. specialist, used to say, you know, sobriety is a condition in which recovery can begin.
Mm-hmm.
You can't begin recovery while you're still using, but it's a condition in which detox is just getting you prepared for recovery.
Mm-hmm.
It is not recovery. And that's one of the big things. That was one of the big problems with managed care for a long time, too, is that they can't understand that now you're clean, you don't need to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're just getting here. You know, mm-hmm. You haven't even been here until now. But that's a really common misconception. And to really know that also it's not just alcohol and drugs that increases that. I mean, we have sex addiction, we have food addiction, we have all kinds of things that we go to for satisfaction because our most usual default system is not available anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what we do at Making Peace and Beyond is really look at some of the false beliefs and the misconceptions and some things that have to do to take that wounded, stumped child and help them to grow and become the person that God intended them to be in the first place.
Mm.
You know, and part of that is, it's interesting because in recovery, we do the very thing that God created us to do.
Yes, yes.
We are transparent. We're vulnerable, as we were in the garden. I mean, that was what being naked meant in the garden, you know. I mean, they were naked. They were vulnerable. They were helpless. They were dependent. And to be with each other. I tell people sometimes I think Jesus left the 99 to go after the one because he thought the 99 could handle each other. You know, I mean, for a while, you know, the body of Christ is much bigger than one person.
Mm.
The one sheep is lost always.
Mm-hmm.
And so to really look at that, to be able to reach out and help those who don't know where they are, don't know what to do, you know, to say there is a way back. I think if I had to say what I would like for my epitaph to be, it would be there's a way back, you know. I mean, because God doesn't give up on us. You know, he's there. We're all prodigals, you know. And I love the sentence in the prodigal son story that he came to his senses, you know. And it's like, I mean, because that's what we have to do.
Yes.
He came to the end of himself and realized he needed his father.
Mm.
And that's a beautiful story of that. But meeting together, being humble. Humble gratitude is such a great way to think about life, you know, because we are so blessed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, and to share with each other in a real way rather than this fake person we made up to present well, it's such a good thing, you know. So I just am really grateful that you know, and I think the way, I mean, what you offer in terms of your understanding of the physiology is so important. I mean, it's so little known to the general population. We just have this weird idea of what we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it is a medical issue that most people do not recover from.
Mm-hmm.
I lost both parents and both husbands to it. And, you know, it's not easy. And they were not ill-educated people. They were not people who didn't have gifts to give, you know, but just, we didn't know.
Yeah.
We didn't know what we didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah, knowing the reality of how much it damages our brains and bodies is really helpful to have patience during that time of early recovery. You know, those first, that first 12 to 18 months is really, really the critical part where we need the most intensive support available to us. We don't ever stop needing the support, but we certainly need a whole ton more in that beginning, because it is so difficult. But to know, hey, this is normal, and this is why it's normal, because my brain is going to take a while to recover, my liver and everything else is going to take a while to recover. it makes more sense to be able to hang in there, understanding that piece. Understanding that, hey, yeah, it's going to be rough, and it's going to be rough for a while. Yeah, you put the drink down, you put the drug down, but your body is going to take a while to recover, and that's okay. Just continue to do what you need to do one day at a time.
You hit your thumb with a hammer, you can throw the hammer away, but your thumb is not well. And you hit your brain with a drug, you can throw the drug away, but your brain is not well. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add before we sign off here?
Yeah, there's so much. You know, there's so much in recovery that we could talk about. I guess for me, you know, one of the other pieces that I would talk about biologically to help reinforce the reality of the need for that recovery support is, you know, the prefrontal cortex of the brain, which is part of the reward system as well. It's part of our executive functioning and decision making. It thinks about consequences. It thinks about, you know, what is it going to mean if I go through with this choice? In addiction, those breaks get ignored. You know, those breaks get ignored. We know that this isn't going to be good, but yet we ignore that and we continue to do it. So as I ignore that, you know, it's a use it or lose it kind of thing in our bodies. And as I ignore throughout my active addiction, ignore the breaks, they become pretty useless. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm in recovery in the beginning, my ability to decide is very, very limited. My ability to say, I mean, how many times did I swear that I swear I was never going to do that again, you know?
Exactly.
And I woke up Saturday morning, I swore I was never going to touch another drink, another drop. And then, you know, 4 hours later, I'm forgetting all about that and I'm at it again, you know? Maybe I'd get a week or two, but that was unusual. Usually it was, you know, half a day. Usually just half a day and I'm back at it, forgetting all about my resolve, my absolute promise and oath, you know, and it wasn't.
You meant it. I meant it as much
as I could mean anything, but it didn't stick. So when we come into early recovery, that prefrontal cortex is not well. And so recovery allows me to borrow the prefrontal cortex of my sponsor, to borrow the prefrontal cortex of other guys in recovery that have been further down the path, to borrow the prefrontal cortex of my therapist. You know, not that they run my life and become my higher power, but they're somebody I can talk to. Hey, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think? I'm faced with this decision. Mm-hmm. What do you think? You know, we say in the first year, you know, because of this exact problem, you don't make any major life changes. Mm-hmm. You don't make any major life decisions, whether that's a relationship, a job, a move, any of that. You got to let this part of that prefrontal cortex heal before you're able to really make good choices again. So, you know, that's an important piece.
Yeah, we say your own best thinking about killed you.
Yes.
Your own best thinking about killed you.
Yeah.
And my friend Al wrote this book called The Recovery Book, and he has this thing where it's divided into three sections, early, mid, and late recovery. Mm. And he had bracelets, red, yellow, and green for each part of it. And when you had a red bracelet on, you didn't get to make any decisions on your own, you know, until your sponsor, your counselor, and your home group thought you were ready to take the red bracelet off and trade it in for a yellow bracelet.
Love it.
And a yellow bracelet, you get to start dealing with job things and relationship things and life things. Mm. And then when you get to the green bracelet, you got to give it away. You got to reach out to others. You got to do stuff. And it really is a good way of thinking about it, I think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then the one last important thing that I've just experienced in my own recovery and that I've battled with, even today, you know, is that it's a we program. That recovery, if I'm doing it on my own, I have stepped out of recovery.
Exactly.
If I'm going back to doing it on my own. And in my addiction, the isolation, active addiction just kept me more and more and more isolated. In the beginning, it was about the party, you know? And it seemed, you know, like I was, you know, life of the party, enjoying all these wonderful connections with friends, you know, we're laughing, we're crying. But you know what? It was, so there's this connection that we long for, this God-given desire for connection to others that we long for, and alcohol seemed to give it to me. But I didn't remember it. It was gone the next morning.
And when I thought through it later, I was throwing up and not having a very good time.
So it's this, we're duped into this artificial, seemingly spiritual experience. that's just not real, and it doesn't really give us anything lasting. But anyway, so as I stay in the addiction, though, you know, isolation just gets gradually worse until I get suicidal. Really, that's where I came to. You know, that was the first rock bottom when I finally had that 7 years. Was, you know, I was suicidal, and I turned to Scripture for the first time, seeking some kind of guidance. You know, seeking some kind of answer, and you know, seeking God's voice. And He spoke. You know, right in that text. You know, He told me about my sin. You know, He told me about what I was struggling with. And the next page, He's telling me how to get out of it, you know? And, you know, it's such a beautiful thing. But getting out of it meant connecting with others. It meant going to Bible study. It meant going to, and then eventually it meant going to, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous for me, and getting with a sponsor, and then doing it with others. And it was still so hard to accept, mm-hmm. because there's such fear, there's such insecurity, there's such shame and guilt. It's overwhelming. So I just want to drink. I just want to forget it. Let me just drink. And but you know, then the, you know, we get to the point where we realize that's not the answer anymore. Like you said, the end of ourselves, the end of our ability to keep lying about doing it on my own is going to work. The end of ourselves realizing I don't have what I need. I can't, that God can, I'm going to let Him. You know, those first step 1, 2, and 3. But in the program, it's so still easy for me to choose to isolate, you know, even though I know better, even though, you mm-hmm. know, I've now, you know, in my current recovery, you know, I just hit, you know, just came over 10 years, and that's 10 years of working with people and in a program where they're helping me in my recovery. But even after all that and working the steps, it's still, you know, I can still choose to do it on my own. You know, I can still, you know, take over the steering wheel instead of letting God have it, you know. And it's so hard. It's just part of our human nature. You know, I got to surrender and surrender and surrender, and hopefully we get better at staying surrendered.
You know, one of the things that I think is so important with what you're saying is, and, you know, one of the unfortunate things in many churches is we go 1, 2, 3, 12. I can't, God can, I'm going to let Him, I'm going to tell everybody. You know, we don't go through the middle steps.
Oh, I did that.
The middle steps are essential for healing. You know, we have to look at ourselves. All the contempt, I mean, every addict I've ever worked with, every alcoholic I've ever worked with, feels contemptuous about themselves. They hate themselves. Mm. And I totally believe that nobody could really love me as me, you know. And in the fourth and fifth and sixth steps, what we're doing is writing down all of the things about ourselves, and then really looking, allowing God, you know, self to see that, God to see that. Guarded and read anyway, but telling one other person, because that one other person is essential, because we're so disconnected from people that telling somebody our story, being totally vulnerable with somebody, and looking into the eyes of acceptance reconnects us with human beings in a way that, if we don't do that, we will never reconnect. We'll just go ahead and build a whole nother self. Now I'll be a religiosity person. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to really be real, but I need to be vulnerable and look into the eyes of acceptance in order to feel like maybe I can have relationships with other human beings. Mm. And that's a very important kind of a thing for all of us, you know, is to get honest and vulnerable. Intimacy is just into me see.
Yes.
It doesn't mean, I mean, we are vulnerable. We are needy. We are limited and dependent on each other. Mm-hmm. And to be able to own that, and that's one of the things I love about Making Peace and Beyond, is on Friday, everybody's kind of nervous about being there and thinking, why did I agree to come? And on Sunday, they don't want to go home because Jesus shows up when grace and truth are the way we act.
Yes.
And so, you know, we become a community, because all of a sudden I can be here with other people. I may not be an addict. I probably am not an addict for the most part in Making Peace and Beyond. But what I am is somebody who's been hiding, who created a being created a self, and God does not love our created self.
The
self that I created, He does not love. He just loves the one He created. And I think that's why both of us love recovery is because we get to be a person in community and just be who we are.
And you said some of those people might not be addicts, but the reality is we all struggle with some kind of addiction. All of us. You know, we all have all kinds of false idols in our lives that get in the way of our relationship with God, ourselves, and others. And you know, 12 steps can be applied to anything and anybody.
So beautiful
and making
program
peace can be applied for healing for anybody. Any human being, you know, needs those kinds of beautiful processes of clearing the wreckage of our past. You know, with the 12 steps, I can get right with God so that I can get right with myself, so that I can get right with others. You know, in my addiction, I got that backwards. I got that bass backwards. I'm trying to fix others. You know, I'm not even thinking I need to get help with my relationship with self, because that's perfect. And God, you know, I'll reach out to Him when I need Him. You know, He's break glass in case of emergency. But, you know, it's all, you know, catawampus, and I got to flip that in recovery and finally get to do it in a way that works.
I love being with you. We may have to do this again sometime.
I'd appreciate that. Yeah, I love the reminders. It's good to, you know, delve into these things and talk out loud about them, because I need to hear it. I need to hear it and remember what's important.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kate, for being you. I really appreciate you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you enjoyed this conversation, please like and subscribe. Leave a review, tell your friends, and join us on all of our social media channels. Thanks again, and God bless you.